This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. There's been a conflict for months now over a proposed Muslim cemetery in the central Mass town of Dudley. But now federal prosecutors want to determine if Dudley officials violated the Muslim applicants' rights to practice their religion by denying their permit to buy the land and build the burial site. WBUR senior reporter David Boweri looks at the latest development in this heated and drawn-out controversy.
Until now, the fight to keep the cemetery out of Dudley has received little coverage, apart from the daily newspaper in Worcester and WBUR. But with the announcement of a civil rights probe, that's quickly changed. Yesterday, Associated Press, Reuters, The Washington Post, and the major media were all calling Dudley Town Administrator Greg Baloukonis.
It's quite unlike anything I've seen in 33 years.
Why is that?
Well, just a small little town.
A small little town now under the glare of national publicity and soon the spotlight of the new civil rights unit that U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz launched in February. In the third paragraph of yesterday's press release, Ortiz says, "We are committed to protecting the rights of Americans of all faiths," before stating in the last line of the last paragraph that her office has not yet made any determination whether Dudley officials violated any rights.
When the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorney, puts you under a microscope, it's a significant matter.
Attorney Jay Tallerman represents the Islamic Society of Greater Worcester, which applied for but was denied a special use permit to develop a cemetery on 55 acres of old farmland in Dudley.
If I was representing a town that was put under the microscope by U.S. attorney, you can be sure it would get my attention.
While his Muslim clients declined to characterize the motivation of their opponents, Tallerman openly blamed religious bigotry. He was later joined by prominent attorney Howard Cooper of Boston. The Dudley Board of Selectmen had begun to implement another plan to stop the cemetery. They were asserting their right of first refusal to buy the land from the owner and thereby keep her from selling it to the Muslim applicants, as she had once agreed. Cooper threatened to file civil rights claims against both the town and various public officials. Now, the U.S. attorney is investigating the same claims. Here's Cooper.
The federal government has not filed a complaint or a lawsuit. They have simply opened an investigation. But it does say something about the situation that it's gotten our government's attention. They don't just investigate things for no reason at all.
Yesterday's announcement came as no surprise to attorneys for the Islamic Society, who have been in close contact with both the U.S. Attorney's Office and the State Attorney General. The town only caught wind of it a couple of days ago, according to Town Administrator Greg Baloukonis, who is speaking for the selectmen.
The town feels as though it didn't violate anyone's religious rights, including the Islamic Society's. And we don't feel that our practices discriminate against anyone on the basis of religion or religious denomination.
What is clear is that both sides are now negotiating in what they say is good faith. That's a development which was not the case before the Islamic Society filed suit with the state land court and threatened to file a civil rights suit against Dudley as well, or before the American Civil Liberties Union stepped in to help. With mounting legal problems and potential costs and a new attorney brought in by the town's insurer, the Board of Selectmen has suspended any effort to buy the land to stop the cemetery. And officials are speaking diplomatically about reaching a resolution. Again, Baloukonis, the town administrator.
And we are optimistic that those discussions will continue and will turn out to be positive at some point.
Attorneys for the Islamic Society hope that the blunt force impact of a federal investigation will help push the town to acquiesce to a Muslim cemetery rather than stiffen its resistance. Either way, small town Dudley has made the news.
We are. Someday we'll probably go back to being anonymous again.
For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boweri.
Residents are being urged to continue or to start water conservation efforts as the state's five-month-long drought shows no signs of letting up. WBUR's Steve Brown tells us while the state can't do anything to make it rain, state officials are doing what they can to ease the situation.
Governor Baker walks with Michael Smolak through a dry and dusty strawberry patch on Smolak's farm in North Andover. Normally, the plants would be a foot tall, but this year, Smolak says, because of the drought, they're only 2 inches high.
How bad is this drought this year?
As bad as I've ever seen it. And I was born in 1952, so I've been around for a few years.
Smolak is a third-generation farmer. He says while his business with diversified crops is doing okay, other farmers are not so lucky.
Dairy farmers do not have hay or pasture to graze because it's all burnt up, so they don't have food. So they're a tough industry anyway, and they're going to be all that much worse off. Cranberry growers don't have water to do harvest in the fall, so they're in a precarious situation. Vegetable crops growers don't have enough water to water their vegetables. They take a lot of water, and so a lot of them have to make the hard decision of which fields do we abandon and which do we water.
With Smolak's farm as a backdrop, Governor Baker outlined steps the state is taking to deal with the drought. Already, the state has declared a drought warning for central and northeastern Massachusetts. The governor urged all citizens to conserve water whenever possible and says he's calling on various state agencies to be ready to provide drought-stricken businesses assistance.
The Department of Agricultural Resources, working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has activated its own internal drought task force to communicate with and monitor the impact on farmers in the agricultural community, including surveying damages to crops. DAR is also identifying state and federal resources that are available to farmers, including emergency water supplies, short and long-term loan or grant opportunities for economic hardship, and the potential for natural disaster declarations.
The governor also encouraged citizens to buy local in an effort to keep Bay State farms afloat during the drought. Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Matthew Beaton says the drought has the potential to have long-lasting impacts on agriculture, the environment, the economy, and public safety.
I echo Governor Baker's comments about encouraging residents to limit outdoor water usage and integrate water-saving techniques into their daily routines. While the measures we are asking folks to take today may seem small and insignificant, I can assure you that their impact is collectively great.
MWRA officials say despite the drought, the system still has plenty of water for its customers and is looking at ways to possibly tie into other systems to provide water should they suffer shortages. A special task force of state agencies that monitors drought conditions is scheduled to meet again next month. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Steve Brown.
While the governor offers support to those in the agricultural business, one local farmer says this drought is the worst he's ever seen.
It's clear to me that there's permanent damage from this drought.
That is Warren Shaw, who runs Shaw Farm, a sprawling dairy farm in Dracut, which has been in the Shaw family for generations. He says while the drought could be catastrophic for many Massachusetts farmers, his operation is in better condition than most. It's because his income is supplemented by a farm store, where he sells his own milk, ice cream, beef, and other goods. But for his milking herd, he's already buying hay and grain from outside sources because he can't grow it in the drought, and he wonders how other dairy farmers will feed their cows this coming winter because there's very little hay and corn growing now to store up. We spoke in his barn, where his black and white Holstein milkers were resting in the heat of the day yesterday.
This is the worst in my lifetime, and statistically, if you look at it, I don't think that there has been this dry a season since 1950. That's my understanding. So there literally has not been anything in my lifetime this bad.
How bad has the drought hurt grass growth in the pastures?
Well, it's almost complete. We put up a crop in May that was very good. We put up a second crop at the end of June that was 20% of what the first was.
And you're talking about grass that you would cut to feed the cows later on in the year.
Right. So the third crop should have been put up already. We haven't bothered to cut it because there's nothing out there. The pastures have dried up, so it's difficult for the cows to find something green to eat out there at this point.
And basically, it's the lack of rain that has prevented the grass from growing.
It is the lack of rain. We haven't had a rainy day all summer, a real traditional rainy day, start to finish. There have been some thunderstorm days, but it's kind of luck of the draw as to whether you get one or not.
So what are you forced to do to make up for it in terms of looking at all your cows and knowing that at the end of the usual grass growing season, you still have to feed them and you're not going to have anywhere near the amount of hay stockpiled you would in a good year?
We're going to have to find an answer to that question. We've already bought some feed, and we bought some corn from another dairy in anticipation of needing more. I have looked at the crop that is currently being grown for us, and it's twisting. So it's clearly not going to grow. And the grain that grows in August for a corn crop is a critical time because that's when the ear is developed, and that's the grain that the cow gets the nutritional benefit from. I'm probably going to have to spend more to buy the grain that I buy, the commercial grain that I buy for the herd, is probably going to have to contain more nutrients and that therefore make it more expensive. So none of it good.
So I have to ask, how long can you sustain this?
Well, I have confidence that it will rain someday. We will get through the year. My biggest concern is what happens to my colleagues in the industry, because they're not going to have feed to feed their cows this winter. I've never seen, just looking forward, I think you're going to see some catastrophic activity in terms of, you know, selling off of dairy herds and things like that.
That's dairy farmer Warren Shaw of Shaw Farm in Draken.
Massachusetts is hot on the trail of what some think is the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail of renewable energy, that is. The state has launched a $10 million energy storage competition. It's seeking demonstration projects to help utilities overcome the biggest drawback to generating electricity from the wind and the sun. That is, they only produce power some of the time. Matthew Beaton is the state energy and environmental affairs secretary.
Storage is the key technology to help us to really use renewables when the sun isn't shining, when the wind isn't blowing. We can still rely on those electrons that were generated from those resources. This is just one of the most exciting areas because there's so many different forms of storage that are out there. So storage is going to be incredibly important.
There are exotic energy storage technologies being developed right now in the state. One is based on the chemistry of rhubarb. Another uses molten glass. We'll be exploring these and other storage technologies in an occasional series of Bostonomics stories here on WBUR. But this morning, WBUR senior correspondent Bruce Gellerman reports on a big battery already in use in Boston that is not on the cutting edge, but is definitely very cool.
A high-pitched hum comes from pumps and boilers in the basement of the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston's Innovation District. But in the seldom-seen sub-basement below, things are a lot quieter and a lot cooler.
Ooh, it's cold in here.
Yes, it is cold in here. Yeah, absolutely. We're storing energy, right?
Paul Valenta, head of marketing and sales for CalMac Manufacturing, stands in front of neat rows of giant gray plastic cylinders. They're frigid to the touch.
They're big, dumb tanks that do what they're told.
And what CalMac's dumb thermal storage tanks do is cool the Moakley Courthouse in a very smart, energy-efficient way. Large pipes filled with glycol antifreeze connect the tanks to a chiller machine, basically a refrigerator. And then smaller tubes filled with the chilled antifreeze circulate inside the tanks.
And those tubes are surrounded by water, and that water freezes solid.
Turning the 65 tanks, each filled with 1,500 gallons of water, into giant ice cubes. And turning the Moakley Courthouse sub-basement into a farm of frozen batteries that can be charged when energy is cheap and harvested when cooling is needed.
And the idea behind the product is, in most parts of the country, energy is half price at night. And so with our system, you create your air conditioning at night, store it in the form of ice, and then use it the next day to offset chiller operation using electricity.
Paul Valenta calls thermal storage the low-hanging fruit of energy demand because buildings account for 2/3 of our use of electricity, and the largest share of that is for cooling. With electricity rates in Boston among the highest in the nation, payback for the Calmex storage system was quick.
What was the price tag for this? Do you know?
I think it was an extra $1.5 million back in 96 when the project bid. So it cost $1.5 million, and the savings were going to be about $1.5 million a year. That's a big number.
Over the past 35 years, Calmec has installed its ice storage system in 4,000 buildings in 50 countries. Outside of the Moakley Courthouse in the Innovation District, 20 new buildings are going up. Stores, condos, commercial space. You'd think buying some big, dumb tanks to save big energy bucks would be a no-brainer, but you'd be wrong. The Moakley sub-basement ice storage system is out of sight in seemingly the minds of developers. Calmec's Paul Valenta.
Even when we go around talking to some consultants in the area, we talk about the courthouse project, and they say, that system hasn't worked for years. They don't even use it anymore. It's been pulled out.
People don't know about this. Very few people know about this. The people who work here know about it. That's about it.
Bill Johnson is chief engineer at the Moakley Federal Courthouse.
The tenants who are here, they want their office the right temperature. They don't care how we do it. So we need to provide air conditioning. It's just not something that they know about, that they're concerned about. They want the end result.
And in a typical commercial building, people want it cheap, which explains why a simple energy storage system like Calmex hasn't caught on like wildfire. It's a matter of literally passing the buck. In real estate circles, it's called the triple net lease. Travis Sheehan is senior infrastructure advisor with the Boston Redevelopment Authority.
Building owners don't necessarily have to create the lowest cost power for their tenants because they're passing those costs through.
Sheehan says real estate developers have no incentive to install more expensive energy storage systems because their first concern is reducing their upfront construction costs to make their rents as attractive as possible.
The flip side to that means standard boilers, standard chillers, standard electrical connections.
Federal buildings can afford the higher upfront costs for ICE energy storage because the owner-occupants, taxpayers, are patient. The system pays off in the long run. Bill Johnson, chief engineer at the Moakley Courthouse.
It's tanks. It's tubing. It doesn't break. It doesn't move. You don't have to grease bearings. You don't have to do anything to it. Whenever we can save money here, we all save.
ICE storage is simple. Unlike other exotic energy storage technologies now under development in the state.
And it is nerdy. It's hard to do, but that's what makes it exciting.
Judith Judson is commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources. She's leading the state's energy storage effort. Massachusetts just became the third state in the nation to pass energy storage legislation.
There's a real opportunity to really change the way we utilize our electric grid infrastructure by adding storage.
If by year's end, Commissioner Judson determines grid-scale storage is viable, cost-effective, and needed, mandatory storage targets will be set, and electric companies in the state will have to start complying by 2020.
We're really looking at becoming a national leader in this area and taking advantage of the potential this technology has. But we haven't seen it take off to the level we want.
The United States has more than enough electric generating capacity. If we could just even out our consumption using a variety of batteries to store energy from renewable resources, U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz predicts the nation could be completely free of fossil fuel power plants by mid-century. It would be revolutionary, something to celebrate, and Paul Valenta of Calmec agrees. The sub-basement of the Moakley Courthouse, where the company's giant energy ice storage system stands, would make a great place to party.
We could have a giant cocktail party here.
Let's go. Real big one, absolutely.
For 90.9 WBUR and Bostonomics, I'm Bruce Gellerman.